We are encouraged that the average fatality rate continues to be low and steady.
Wrong. You're lying, Mr. Vice President. Stop doing that, please.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV. In Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. In Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. In Janesville, Wisconsin on WADR. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, amongst others. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Coming up, we will be joined by a guest to explain why he believes, according to a recent opinion article that he wrote, that it is, quote, not just possible, but increasingly probable that Donald Trump could both lose the election and still remain president. Seriously. And no, this is not some crackpot lefty or some, you know, from some alt news site trying to scare the hell out of all of us, even though that is what is happening here.
It is very scary.
But he's a former U.S. senator who has served in government since the Johnson administration, who also worked for Richard Nixon, writing about this nightmarish scheme in Newsweek. So that former senator joins us shortly to explain. So for something much less scary, let's talk about the deadly pandemic here for a bit in the U.S., shall we?
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, I love my job these days. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
So, all right. Now, I hate to keep pounding on Florida's Republican Governor Rick DeSantis.
But you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, it's actually not true. I wish I didn't have to keep pounding on him is really what it is. But I do, because his irresponsible, obnoxious Trumpism, as many tried to tell him, including us for weeks on this program, is now costing very real lives of Americans. We have played this clip before. We will probably play it again as a reminder about how Republican governors like DeSantis and yes, Republican presidents like Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence are absolutely choosing knowingly to kill their constituents by ignoring health experts in hopes that somehow it's going to improve Republican chances at the polls this November, even though it will not. I mean, it is just that simple, and it's as simple and, yes, cynical, I guess, but that's it. That's what it is. If we didn't have an election coming up in 116 days, but who is counting, I'm certain that these idiots would not be acting as reckless as they are right now with the lives of fellow Americans in order to get some sort of short-term spike in otherwise dreadful economic numbers, because, you know, they think that that would somehow lessen the likelihood of a blue tsunami that could wash over them this November 3rd. So, yeah, here's that clip again of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at the White House with Mike Pence by his side back in May, demanding an apology from those of us in the media who reported what actual health experts warned about his too early reopening of the Sunshine State just a couple of months ago.
You got a lot of people in your profession who waxed poetically for weeks and weeks about how Florida was going to be just like New York. Wait 2 weeks, Florida's going to be next. Just like Italy, wait 2 weeks. Well, hell, we're 8 weeks away from that, and it hasn't happened.
Yeah, well, as it turns out, it has happened. It has happened now. Just as scientists warned that it would, Governor, and you've got blood on your hands. From AP today, fighting a surge in coronavirus cases in the spring, Florida appeared to be flattening the curve as theme parks shuttered, sugar sand beaches closed, and residents heeded orders to stay home. Now, it's almost as if that never happened. Bars, restaurants, and gyms began reopening in May. Yes, that clip of DeSantis, that was from May, May 20. What critics said it was too soon, says AP, and weeks later, the Sunshine State became one of the country's virus hotspots, experiencing an alarming surge in cases. On Thursday, officials reported 120 deaths in one single day from COVID, the highest number since the previous record of 113 back in early May. Dr. Jason Wilson, an ER physician at Tampa General Hospital, said during a conversation with Tampa's mayor, Jane Castor, this week, "We thought maybe we could keep this thing under wraps, but eventually it caught up to us." Yep, it did. From Miami to Tampa to Jacksonville, where the RNC still plans to hold its nominating convention for Donald Trump next month, even though at least five sitting Republican senators so far have said they ain't gonna go take part in that death trap. Since then, hospitals in June and July have seen their numbers of coronavirus patients triple. With new patients outpacing those being discharged. That does not happen, as Trump and DeSantis and Pence have been trying to gaslight people, because there is more testing. It happens because there is more very sick people who require hospitalization, just as we've also been warning now for months on end. AP reports a record 435 new hospitalized patients were reported Friday to have tested positive for the virus. More than 45% of intensive care units in Florida hospitals are now at capacity or had fewer than 10% of their beds available as of Friday. Hospital networks are scrambling to hire more healthcare workers to expand their COVID units. Last week, hospitals in several cities in Florida announced that they would again halt or reduce non-emergency procedures in order to free up space. Donald Trump, of course, is so worried about this situation in the state of Florida that he's headed down there on Friday for several campaign fundraisers. Hope he stays safe. Florida's predicament echoes that of other current hotspots, which also opened too early, reports AP. On Thursday, Texas, which is now marking its deadliest week of the pandemic, reported a record daily death toll of more than 100. A new high for hospitalizations for the 10th consecutive day, and a nearly 16% positive test rate, its highest yet. Yes, that test rate keeps going up. That's the rate of tests that are coming back positive. Not just an increase in the number of tests leading to, you know, more positive tests, but an increase in the rates of those tests that are coming back positive. As, you know, they had been lying to you for weeks about, oh, well, it's just we have more cases because we're doing more testing. So that's what you have been lied to about for weeks, among other things, not on this show, but many other places, thanks to the false narrative that Republicans have been pushing. Remember Sean Hannity on that same day, May 20, same day that DeSantis embarrassed himself by yelling at the media for reporting what scientists had warned?
Florida got it right. Texas got it right. And guess what? Now it's time for all the states to follow their lead. We need to learn from the abject failures, meaning New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Michigan. This is where we learn from the dumb ideas and the dumb policies that were made in the middle of Corona. Did they do it on purpose? No, I don't think they did it on purpose. Did they do it because they're stupid? Yeah, that's a big part of the reason. And the mob and the media, by the way, You owe Governor DeSantis a huge apology.
Oh, do we? Do we, Sean? Perhaps I missed the huge apology that you have since afforded to the mob and the media. Or you're just not reporting on the massive increases in hospitalizations and deaths now in Florida and Texas, thanks to the Republican governors who did not get it right. They opened up too early. Of course, it wasn't just the Republican governors DeSantis in Florida and Governor Greg Abbott in Texas who opened too soon. Republican Governor Doug Ducey in Arizona, he wanted so much to please Donald Trump that by way of thanking him for coming to visit him in Arizona back in May, Ducey announced on that very same day that he would be reopening Arizona weeks earlier than planned. This past week in Arizona, hospitals were at nearly 90% capacity with a record 3,437 patients hospitalized as of Wednesday and a record number of those, 575 on ventilators, according to health officials. Earlier in the week, a record high number of 871 patients filled ICU beds in Arizona. Chad Nielsen, the infection prevention director for UF Health Jacksonville Hospital in Florida, anticipates the hospital will run out of rapid test kits in about 2 weeks or maybe sooner because manufacturers cannot keep up with demand. So great, no rapid test kits in Jacksonville, Florida in August when the city is set to host the Republican National Convention. Those are definitely the type of people with the sort of foresight and concern for the general welfare of the public that you definitely want to elect to public office this year, aren't they? Those Republicans who would move their convention out of North Carolina because they wouldn't let them hold a maskless death rally up there. So they moved it down to Jacksonville where there are no more rapid tests. The rise in Florida hospitalizations comes as physicians and nurses have been working around the clock now for months. During the summer, the hot summer, when facilities are typically low-staffed, Esther Segura, a nurse at Miami Jackson's South Medical Center, said, "We're just overwhelmed with patients right now. It's like all hands on deck." She said her and her colleagues are weary after 4 months working in the pandemic. "Now we're just spiking all the way," she says. "Every day, the numbers keep surging." But don't worry. Republicans like Mike Pence and those folks at Fox News and the others who are either pretending or actually gullible enough to believe this whole thing has been a hoax or a mountain out of a molehill or whatever they've been, you know, they've been demanding more apologies from the media of late because I guess we're not adequately covering the fact that while infections and hospitalizations are up, death rates are not rising at the same rate. That's a great success, according to Mike Pence, who says they've even been falling in many places. Of course, for the responsible journalist to report that, you would also have to report that death rates are a lagging indicator to infection and hospital rates. But that's a really complex idea for these gullible wingnut loons who have been brainwashed for so many years. Difficult for them to understand that. So that lagging indicator, as health experts had warned, the death rate, well, it is now catching up in some of these states, some of these same states where they opened too early. According to the LA Times today, soaring coronavirus infections in Texas, Arizona, and Florida are pushing deaths from the disease back upward, reversing 2 months of declines and undercutting claims by the Trump administration that the pandemic is under control. In Texas, where hospitals are being swamped by a wave of COVID-19 patients, the 7-day average of deaths hit 46 a day this week. That is more than double the daily average in mid-June. The average death toll in Arizona has also more than doubled in the last month. And in Florida, hello, Ron DeSantis. Another state where infections are skyrocketing, the daily average of coronavirus-related deaths has jumped 60% in just the past 2.5 weeks. I'm sure Hannity has been all over that statistic, right? Even while they're out there yelling at the media, what the media isn't telling you is that death rates are going down. Are they? Apparently not. At least if you're, you know, concerned about things like facts and reality. We should be very concerned, said Dr. Eduardo Sanchez, a former Texas health commissioner who now serves as chief medical officer for prevention at the American Heart Association. And we should be thinking about what needs to be done to change this trend. Oh, I got an idea. Let's hold a huge event inside an arena in one of the hottest hotspots in Florida to nominate the great Donald Trump for a second term. That'll change the trend, right? Did I mention how much I love my job lately? With other states across the South and West wrestling with surging infections, public health officials, hospital leaders, and experts are eyeing the trends with growing anxiety, fearful that they will see a reversal of what had been declining death tolls. Right. They were declining thanks to the lockdowns. And now they are rising again thanks to the reopening. This is not rocket science, but it is science. The trend is very upsetting, said Lisa McCormick, the associate dean at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, their School of Public Health. Alabama, where the number of new coronavirus cases has quadrupled since mid-May. Quadrupled. They have seen deaths hold relatively steady, but McCormick said few expect that pattern to hold. Correct, because as the infection rates go up, the death rates go up in return. Nationally, as we noted earlier this past week, a new forecast from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington now predicts that the U.S. will record more than 200,000 deaths related to the coronavirus by November 1. That's up from about 130,000 deaths right now. So we've got at least another 70,000 Americans scheduled to die between now and Election Day because of the failure of this administration and its lackeys around the country to act responsibly. And, well, at least Donald Trump is in Florida today for fundraisers, campaign fundraisers with rich Republicans. So it's not like he's doing nothing, right? Dr. Christopher Murray, director of the Institute at the University of Washington, whose disease models are closely followed worldwide, despite being very conservative. They've even been cited many times by the White House, so surely they know about this. They just don't care. Dr. Murray said, we can now see the projected trajectory of the epidemic into the fall, and many states are expected to experience significant increases in cases and deaths. President Trump and others in his administration have repeatedly cited the overall downward trend in fatalities to argue that it is safe to reopen businesses and schools. Look, deaths are going down. Vice President Mike Pence told reporters on Wednesday, he, quote, we are encouraged that the average fatality rate continues to be low and steady. That as administration officials urged schools across the country to allow students back in the classrooms this fall, beginning next month.
It is quite a mind-blowing statement for the vice president to say that they are encouraged by a steady mass death rate. Quite the campaign slogan.
You know, I have a subscription to the LA Times. Maybe the administration, they don't have that. Maybe they can't afford that. They can't afford to read this information in the LA Times because they don't have a subscription. Dr. David Lakey, chief medical officer at the University of Texas healthcare system, and others noted that the steep increase in patients being hospitalized now with COVID-19 suggests that larger fatality numbers are likely coming in the next few weeks. This week, there are nearly 10,000 COVID patients in Texas hospitals, 10,000, according to state data, in the hospital. Not infected, but in the hospital. That is more than triple from the total just 3 weeks ago. The widespread socializing that occurred when the governors of Texas, Florida, Arizona, and other states began loosening restrictions in the spring is only now starting to be reflected in the death rates, reports the LA Times. As I have to say it, but as we have been warning for all of those weeks, specifically about Texas and Arizona and Florida. Meanwhile, Tennessee's daily deaths have been gradually trending up since the end of May, when the governor issued an executive order allowing groups of up to 50 people to participate in social and recreational activities. Who could have predicted that would be a problem? Of course, I know many Americans still believe in American exceptionalism. Well, it is certainly on display right now. The widespread rise in infections and increasing death tallies distinguish the U.S. from most wealthy nations in Europe and East Asia that have much more successfully managed the pandemic, bringing their infection and death rates way down, very nearly where they were before the outbreak, but not the U.S., because we're exceptional. Many of these countries were more careful about reopening businesses after the virus first hit this spring, according to the Times, but they report, don't worry, the U.S. experience is not unique. According to Ali Mokhtad, an epidemiologist at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, who spent two decades at the CDC, he notes that Iran, which suffered one of the worst coronavirus outbreaks this spring, similarly locked down, but then also prematurely relaxed restrictions, according to Mokhtad, allowing infections and deaths to spring back. This week, the country of Iran recorded its highest number of COVID fatalities since February. Cool. We're just like Iran. Well done, Mr. President. You nailed it. Mokhtad says we were lulled into a false sense of security here. People let down their guard, and I'm very concerned the message is now coming out that we can be reassured and just reopen schools. Because, you know, that's the message. That is the message that both Trump and Pence and, yes, DeSantis have been putting out this entire past week. Schools must be reopened next month. And if they are not, pressure will be applied to force them to do so, including the withholding of federal funds, the deportation of foreign exchange students who are attending schools who do not agree to have in-person classes open up 5 days a week. Mokhtad warned, we are headed in the wrong direction. And so do we. We warn that as well. And so we have been warning that as well. And I am sorry about that, because I suspect that it gets exhausting and not really very fun to hear. I know I do not enjoy doing it, repeating these warnings, sharing these actual facts. I really don't. I don't like doing it, but I feel like if I don't, I feel like I might be responsible for someone unnecessarily dying. And I have trouble with that, maybe because I have a conscience, unlike people like Donald Trump and Mike Pence and Ron DeSantis and Sean Hannity, who are even now continuing their COVID-19 death march for tens of thousands of Americans, despite all of these warnings, because they think that somehow this is going to help them get reelected and stay in power. They are wrong. At least I hope that they are wrong. While we have spent months warning you about exactly where we are today in regard to the COVID virus, I'm really hoping that the warning that we have for you in the next segment here on the broadcast, when I'm joined by a former U.S. senator, I really hope that warning does not come to pass. It regards the presidential election in just over 100 days and how, if this former senator is correct, Donald Trump could both lose the election, not just the popular vote, but even the Electoral College vote, and still be allowed to stay in office. And it would all be perfectly lawful. Seriously. Because I guess we need to have the scariest show ever today, right? Sorry, that's what you get from the reality-based media outlets. My apologies. Buckle up. That story with Senator Tim Worth is next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.
Now they're planning the crime of the century. Well, what will it be?
Well, we'll tell you what it will be. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Former Colorado Senator Timothy Wirth and Newsweek editor-at-large Tom Rogers freaked out, really scared the hell out of more than just a few folks a week or so ago, just before the 4th of July holiday, with a short article in Newsweek headlined, "How Trump Could Lose the Election and Still Remain President." It begins this way. It is increasingly looking as if Joe Biden can beat President Donald Trump in November. The president seems more and more out of step with the national mood, from his handling of the pandemic to his response to racially biased policing, not to mention a wide array of other issues, even in key swing states. Donald Trump is losing ground that will be difficult for him to make up. For Trump, there are, however, two broad pathways to maintaining power. First, we can already see very clearly a strategy designed to suppress voter turnout with the purging of registration rolls of large numbers of mostly urban voters, efforts to suppress mail-in ballots, which are more necessary than ever given COVID-19. Of course, as we on this program have been reporting on the huge con that Donald Trump and his wildly corrupt Attorney General Bill Barr are hoping to pull off by convincing voters that absentee ballots are all fraudulent, even though Donald Trump himself voted unlawfully by absentee ballot in Florida earlier this year, where he has no permanent legal domicile for voting purposes. But I digress. Back to Wirth and Rogers here in Newsweek. The Trump campaign has a re-election apparatus that is training 50,000 poll watchers for the purpose of challenging citizens' right to vote on Election Day and significant efforts to make in-person voting in urban areas as cumbersome as possible in order to have long lines that discourage people from exercising their voting rights. That's one of the two pathways that Wirth and Rogers see as a potential path to maintaining power, and all of it we have been covering in some detail for many months here on the Bradcast. But as to the second pathway, they write, "The second pathway to subverting the election is even more ominous, but we must be cognizant of it because Trump is already laying the groundwork for how he can lose the popular vote and even lose in the key swing states necessary for an electoral college victory, but still remain president." Seriously? Really? Well, that seems impossible, at least until you read their clearly explained 12-step process by which, if all of his cards line up, Trump actually could manage to, if you will, steal the election in plain sight, lawfully, sort of, with some assistance from the stolen Republican majority on the U.S. Supreme Court and help from Republicans in Congress to seal the deal. While the scenario that the two men spell out seems something straight out of a dystopian political fiction novel akin to the Philip Roth book recently made into an HBO miniseries called The Plot Against America, Wirth and Rogers at Newsweek argue that this scenario is plausible enough that they felt the need to write this opinion piece in Newsweek. And they end it with this warning: there needs to be an outpouring at all levels of society that this scheme that they lay out will not be tolerated from government officials and lawmakers at all levels, to civic associations and civil rights groups, to business groups and trade associations, who have to recognize the economic chaos that would result from this kind of coup, to lawyers, academics, and student groups practiced in resisting government policies, and of course, to the editorial voices of the press, both local and national. Well, consider it done, gentlemen. Here we go. Joining us now to help us with that outpouring and to help explain this kind of, sort of, actually lawful coup that could keep Donald Trump in office even if he loses is one of the two co-authors of that Newsweek piece. Tim Wirth is a former U.S. senator and congressman from Colorado with a long and distinguished career. He served in the Johnson White House and as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Education in the Nixon administration. Then as a Colorado congressman from 1975 to 1987 when he was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he focused a great deal on environmental issues. Thank you, sir. He also went on to serve as national co-chair for the Clinton-Gore campaign. And from 1993 to 97, Senator Wirth served in the U.S. Department of State as the first undersecretary for global affairs. Apparently, he couldn't hold a job. And as if that's not enough, as a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, he was recently honored as a champion of the Earth by the United Nations Environment Program. Senator Wirth, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Well, Brad, you've got it all there. I don't have to say anything. I'll just leave it to you.
No, I think you do, because you're going to have to explain these 12 steps, which I left out. Before we get there, congratulations on scaring the hell out of even me a week or so ago when I first read this article. Before we get to those 12 steps and the details, have you received yet the outpouring of concern from all of the levels that you cited that you feel need to be aware of the possibility of this sort of scheme by this president and his lackeys and apparatchik who would be needed to pull it off?
I'll put it this way, Brad. People are starting to wake up to the possibility that Vice President Biden wins and wins big, that still is no guarantee that Trump's going to leave the White House. I think that if you look at Trump and just what we've learned in the last 3.5 years, this is a man who is absolutely deathly afraid of the word loser. That's the way I put it, big, good loser. And he does not want to go down in history as the biggest loser in American political history. And he will do everything he possibly can to avoid that and to stay in office. Mm. And we've seen that in this government, which is based upon a lot of norms and protocols that people agree that this is a certain way of doing things, he's made it very clear that he doesn't understand these and he doesn't agree with them anyway. Even if he understood them, he's going to do what he wants to do. And it's those norms and protocols that make transitions within our government work. Well, you know, the reason that and if he's not going to, if he doesn't go along with those, which I think is very clear, he hasn't gone along with any other ones, then we got real troubles ahead.
Well, you know, I've heard the concerns that even if he loses, he's not going to leave, and I have personally felt that that's somewhat overblown. In that, I really actually don't think the military would go along with that sort of thing. I believe that he would be removed. But you and Tom Rogers here actually point out a scenario that is somewhat different than the idea that, well, I lost, but I'm going to stay here anyway. You actually point out a way that this could be legalized, if you will, and you note that he actually tweeted in advance, sort of setting up for this. He tweeted on June 22nd, quote, "Rigged 2020 election. Millions of mail-in ballots will be printed by foreign countries and others. It will be the scandal of our times." And with this, you're right, Trump has begun to lay the groundwork for the step-by-step process by which he holds on to the presidency after he has clearly lost the election. So let's walk through this. Yeah.
Let's go back to the two pathways that you started and you read about right at the top. There's a pathway around November is consuming the time and effort of almost all the pundits thinking about this, and that is the electoral one. What happens in the election? Will there be a lot of mail-in balloting? How will this go down in the six or seven key states, in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Arizona, Florida? What's going to happen there? Will they be able then to count the ballots? And if they can count the ballots, how will that counting come out? Mm-hmm. Who's going to do that counting? What if there isn't a majority of electoral votes, and it goes to the Electoral College in December, and it's stuck, and there isn't a majority, and we then have to follow the very tortured procedure that's laid out in part in the Constitution. This is the electoral pathway, mm-hmm. and there are lots and lots of ways in which he can disrupt the election, in which he can create very significant electoral chaos, both at the ballot box in these key states and in the process of recounting. But there's the second pathway, which mm-hmm. we think is equally, if not more dangerous, is this suite of very powerful emergency powers which the president has. He is effectively under Article 2 of the Constitution. He can do practically anything that he wants to do. Mm. There are no constraints on his use of these emergency powers, which were first began to be granted to him about the time of the Eisenhower administration, mm-hmm. and concerns about a nuclear attack and what would happen to the government at that point and who would be in charge. And that then grew into concerns about what happened during a biological attack or a chemical attack. And that, in turn, emergency powers were developed, what happens in terms of terrorism, and then what happens in terms of a massive healthcare epidemic. The president is given, in all of these situations, very serious emergency powers. And there's no review of these powers. Mm-hmm. The Congress actually knows very little about them. They are in statute, but they are held by the Justice Department and by the White House. The Congress has had little or no attention to these. They have not heard hearings about them. They don't know what's in these emergency powers. They've not reviewed them. And that's a really dereliction, we think, on the part mm-hmm. of the Congress. And one of the antidotes to all of this is for the Congress to begin to address these issues in each of the various of the committees of the House, particularly mm-hmm. where they have the ability to hold those hearings. They control the hearing agenda and can certainly have hearings on what these powers are. Trump has no constraints on these. The Congress doesn't have any authority to check these powers. Mm-hmm. People can say, well, it would go to court. Well, who's going to take them? Who's going to take it to court? Barr, the Attorney General. Are they going to challenge what Trump says he's going to do? Well, and even if they do challenge it, would this be like Andrew Jackson in the 1830s, when people came to him and said, "Oh, by the way, the Supreme Court justice has said that you can no longer move the Cherokees west," and Andrew Jackson said, "Well, that's fine. If the Chief Justice has an army, let him come and tell me what to do."
You and what army? Well, let's step through how those emergency powers might be invoked here. The scenario where you write that Biden ends up winning in the popular vote and in the electoral states, in key swing states like Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. But then he declares the election was rigged and invokes the emergency powers at that time to stop the counting. Do I understand it correctly?
That's certainly one of the things that he can do. He can say, under his emergency health powers, these ballots were all infected by the COVID, and they shouldn't have been cast and can't be cast, and the people who counted them weren't legitimate counters. Whatever he might decide mm-hmm. Are the grounds to declare that the counting that's gone on in these of the electoral votes isn't valid, and or that the majorities that are reported back by in the state of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Reported back by the state legislature, which is Republican, are different from the votes reported back by the governor, who's a Democrat, mm-hmm. and it goes to the Electoral College, and they meet in December, and can't decide. Then what happens? So that's what happened in 1876, and it went to the Electoral College. They tied. They couldn't decide what to do, and that's when they eventually cut the deal between Rutherford B. Hayes, and he became president in return for giving away Reconstruction across the South. I mean, very, very mm-hmm. important decision that was made at that point. But that was the way that they broke the tie,
right.
In 1876.
Now,
under the law, under the current legislation, under that current legislation, if there's a tie now, ultimately it goes to a vote of the House of the delegations in the mm-hmm. House of Representatives. and that's not anything but one vote for every state. Wyoming has a vote, California has a vote, they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the votes then of the House of Representatives, there are currently 26 houses that are Republican-controlled, 24 that are democratically controlled. If there were a vote like that in the House today, they would most certainly be voting for Trump.
Now, the most sort of insidious part of this, as I read it, is that you can have a number of states. In other words, it's not an actual tie in the Electoral College, but it becomes either a tie or just an outright victory for Donald Trump if he is able to essentially declare an emergency in these various states that have to be investigated because we're not sure if the counts are legitimate. And ultimately, what happens is it goes to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says if you can't come up with, as we saw them do in Bush v. Gore back in 2000, if you can't come up with an electoral college winner in your state, then that state will simply not be included in the ultimate electoral college count, correct? So we would just remove a number of states because there's an ongoing emergency, an investigation that can't get completed by the time the college meets, and that's how we end up with a tie or even a Trump victory, even in a case where Biden has literally received more votes in the electoral college otherwise.
Well, that's part of the complexity that we're facing. It's a real, potentially, I think, a major constitutional crisis. And so we then have to say to ourselves, we can try to unravel this some more. It's very, very complicated, and lawyers have spent more than 100 years trying to figure this out. And, you know, in the 1880s, the Congress tried to unravel what would happen and really made a mess of it in the legislation. And then since then, have been able to sort through a clear set of procedures as to what happens if, what if, what if, what if. So we're stuck with what we have now.
Yeah.
And we're stuck with this threat, it seems to us, which is a very real threat. And our belief is it's no longer possible that Trump's going to make this kind of a challenge, but it's highly probable.
Yeah.
If you assume, as we do, that, again, going back to where we started, he'll do anything he possibly can to stay in power.
Yeah, when you say it's not just possible, but increasingly probable, that's what I wanted to ask you. Why do you feel that way at this point?
Well, the more you know, the worse it is. If you look, the more you know about these emergency powers, the more you sketch out what he may do, the more you see what he's doing in all of these swing states and how they're trying to discourage the vote by mail, and how you know he's making all kinds of wild statements about how corrupt the electoral voting would be if it's conducted by mail. I mean, he's really obviously on a full, all-out attack against voting by mail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that now. That's in their the data that's out there. We know that the president is moving rapidly to put in a different kind of civilian leadership at the Pentagon. Now, why is he doing that? You know, what's the reason for that at this late time of the administration? You know, we know that he's taken over the Voice of America and all of the various broadcasting entities mm-hmm. that exist there. Why is he doing that at this late date? We know that he has very and significant powers under the Communications Act of 1934, in which he has the opportunity to make major inroads, if not shut down altogether, the Internet upon which so much of the country depends. So the more you look at this and the more you begin to think it through, you say to yourself, well, wait a minute, it would really take a failure of imagination not to begin to think that this is not, as you're suggesting, not just possible, but mm-hmm. probable. Let's connect the dots. Let's connect all of these dots together and see what's going on and say, as we do, that the president and the attorney general and their minions are bent upon staying in office at all costs.
It is chilling, and I would I'll add one sort of variation to your scenario, or perhaps a nuance in your 12-step nightmare plan that you spell out at Newsweek, Senator. Trump, as you note, has been busy discrediting vote by mail, and the Washington Post recently reported that Republican voters are listening to him, increasingly planning to not vote by mail, but at in person at the polls, where Democrats are planning to vote more by mail in larger numbers. Well, in-person polling place results are generally reported on election night, whereas absentee results can take several days or even weeks to come in. I could see a scenario where some of these swing states with, heavy in-person Republican votes actually go for Trump on Election Day, but then flip to Biden in the weeks thereafter, after the, vote-by-mail ballots come in and are tallied. And I would see that as absolutely leading to Trump declaring those states have been stolen from him. Just, we saw something like that just in 2018 in California, where he tried to make that claim that California was stealing these four congressional seats from Republicans.
Yeah, what you're talking about is the so-called blue wave phenomena that occurs in many cases with absentee ballots that, red votes tend to come in more during the day of voting, and blue votes, absentee tend to be more absentee.
Mm-hmm.
So when the blue votes or the absentee votes get counted, you have a swing. I think that happened in a congressional district in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
That on election night in 2018, the Republican had been declared a victor, but or they said they were ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And but then when all the absentees came in, it turned out that the Democrat won. That's what's called the blue wave mm-hmm. phenomena. So people are thinking about that. You're absolutely right, and that's one of the many variables in all of this that we have to be aware of.
I'm speaking with
Sam. But the next point that we have to really go at now a little bit, I think, is very, very important to do, Brad, and that's to talk about what we do about this.
Right, and that's what I want to get to. I'm speaking with Senator Tim Worth, former U.S. Senator from Colorado, and along with what we do about this, Senator, do you feel confident, given the way that the Supreme Court has decided a bunch of cases in recent days, that they, and I'm thinking of John Roberts here, would they actually go along with this sort of, because they would be needed here, I think, to go along with this pretty transparent scheme to essentially steal the presidency in plain sight?
Well, tell me this, who's going to bring the suit to this, get it to the Supreme Court?
You and me, Senator.
Through the district court and through the Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court.
Yep. You've
got an attorney general sitting there with various orders coming from the president. He can legitimize and say these are perfectly all right, and you can imagine the scenario where the court looks at this and says these orders from the president are perfectly legal.
Yep.
And they stand aside, which they have historically done when it came to voting and it came to issues surrounding voting. Supreme Court has stood aside. So timing is one thing, probably the most important, and I think the predilections of the court are generally not to become involved, standing aloof from all of this sort of thing.
Okay, so what can we, the people, do here and now to somehow help avoid this nightmare scenario from playing out in reality?
Well, what we call it is we have to all together build an extraordinarily large and powerful, what we call a citizen's firewall, a firewall against this happening, since there are no formal guardrails on the president. There are none in the law. The Senate obviously is not going to do anything. We wouldn't count on the court. So it has to be a very, very broad public uprising of governors and attorneys general and secretaries of state, people at all levels of government across the country being aware of what may be happening and beginning to gird themselves for this. It's businesses and industry, that businesses have to be very acute to the chaos that may be coming. And their responsibility, they are under the law, corporations, they're individuals too, as you'll remember what the Supreme Court said. These corporations have a responsibility. I don't know if you've seen recently James Carville and talking about the vote in Georgia. Carville says, what's wrong with Coca-Cola and what's wrong with Delta Airlines? Mm. Why do they let this kind of voting occur in Georgia? I can just as easily buy Pepsi-Cola or I can fly on American Airlines. They got to get after these corporations. They've got a stake in this, too. Well, that's true, and the Chambers of Commerce have a stake and the Business Roundtable and all these very, very significantly important business organizations have to say, well, we are anticipating that this may happen, and we want our people to know and talk about it and think about it. That's something that universities have to be doing and student groups have to be doing. And, of course, the press in every way, shape, and form has to be doing. And the press has generally been bystanders. They will make the argument, oh, we can't get involved in something partisan. You know, oh, we have to be nonpartisan. We have to be balanced. Well, this is not a matter of being balanced or not partisan.
Mm-hmm.
This is a matter of the survival of our democracy and the way in which our electoral system works. And the press has to be attentive to that and be thinking about that and doing the analysis of what this is. It doesn't have to mean that they're saying that they're for Trump or they're not for Trump or whatever. It's just that there is a danger in our system, and we have to build public attention to this so that it doesn't happen. And finally, this has to be done early on. We can't wait until the middle of October or early November to kind of ring the alarm bells.
Mm-hmm.
The alarm bells, in our opinion, have to go off now, and that's why we're feeling a little bit like an early Paul Revere or whatever. You know, we're raising the alarm, and the problems are coming, and let's everybody be thinking about them and working on them and talking about that together, which is, again, why I was so pleased to be able to join you on your program and talk about it, because people have to talk about it and think about it and understand that, this is not a politician's gaming, and this is not just a possibility, but something that could be a real probability, and we should be alert to it and aware of it and thinking about it and talking about it and building the firewall against it.
You're right. It's not a partisan issue. It is an American issue, and we are happy to join you in that fight, sir. Happy to join your citizens' firewall and talk about this. Get the word out, and we will, of course, link to your article over at Newsweek, How Trump Could Lose the Election and Still Remain President. Senator, I hope
I'll send you. We did a long piece in Politico, too, which I'll send to you and a couple of other things, so you can have those on hand as you're talking to your listeners and as we all think about what has to be done over the next 3 months.
Yes, please do send that information. Let us know how we can help to continue getting this word out. Thank you for what you're doing here. And by the way, for your work on climate as well. I know you work with the UN on that, and I hope you'll come back and join us again to discuss that nightmare once this current one is beyond
everything happens at once. You know, we used to think that the plague is coming. Well, the plague is on us. Now we got the locusts are heading our way.
Literally, yeah. Unfortunately. Senator Tim Worthy is former Democratic congressman and U.S. Senator from Colorado and still fighting to save the world. Thank you, Senator. Hope we get to talk to you again in the near future.
Talk to you soon. Thanks for asking me to join you.
You bet. Our honor, Senator. All right, quick break, and we are back. Desi Doyen, you know what we need, what the whole world needs right now?
What?
A little Randy Rainbow.
Okay.
Okay. Quick break.
Good.
And we're back with that right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. We don't have time for that. We don't have time for this sort of frivolity. We need to leave here with a smile, tapping our toes and clicking our heels. And so for that, we turn to our friend Randy Rainbow.
Again, we had the strongest economy in the world.
Girl.
Did you have one in the back here, please?
Thank you. Mr. President, COVID cases continue to rise around the country. You said in your last stand-up special that you had asked your people to slow down testing in order to make the numbers look better, which, by the way, is f***ing brilliant. You're also not requiring people to wear masks at your rallies, which, well, that doesn't matter. Nobody goes to those anyway. But don't you think you should be following CDC guidelines and leading by example?
They're not mandatory guidelines. They're guidelines. They suggest you could wear them.
Huh?
I mean, most people can just make something out of a certain material. I won't be doing it personally.
You're looking awful grouchy.
cover your freaking face. Listen to Dr. Fauci, cover your freaking face. Don't wait around for herd immunity, you reckless thug. And what a golden opportunity to hide that mug. Although you should require us to do what's right to do, you're siding with the virus, 'cause you're a virus too. So back up, girl, don't get in my space, and cover your freaking face.
I don't see it for myself, I just don't.
And if you're feeling fancy, or on your way to prom, why not be more like Nancy? Make it a whole ensemble, yes. Tie up your face with a bandana, please. It's not taboo. Think of your poor old ailing Nana. She's counting on you not to kill her. Please don't politicize it. Don't be a pox like Pence. Don't sit and scrutinize it. It's only common sense. Don't spread droplets all over the place. Ew! Cover your freaking face.
You can do it, you don't have to do it. I'm choosing not to do it.
Da-da-dum, da-dum-dum, dance break. And in the same way, testing less would make COVID just quit. Maybe if we can't see your mouth, you won't say stupid sh**. Don't thumb your nose at science. You'll find it doesn't work. Ooh, knock off that non-compliance. Don't be a selfish jerk. Just stop drooling and slow down the pace. Just cover your freaking face.
Wearing a face mask, I don't see it for myself.
Cover your freaking face.
I'm choosing not to do it.
Girl, just put a paper bag over that thing.
I really needed that. Thank you very much, Desi Doy, and our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, including our interview today with former Colorado U.S. Senator Tim Wirth, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com to share with and scare the hell out of your friends, families, neighbors, and mortal enemies. That is free to you at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help keep us on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, you will find me there at simply The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Cover your freaking face.
I'm choosing not to do it.
Girl, just put a paper bag over that thing.